Let's pray. Lord, once again, I come to you and ask you to give me the words to say and give them the ears to hear the right words. And I thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. It's good to see all those Moxie shirts out there. When I was in the hospital in Jacksonville, I got a special air freight delivery of Moxie. And if you don't believe me, Judy's got, it's on Facebook, you can see it, sitting there in the hospital room drinking Moxie. It was kind of fun to, they don't have Moxie in Jacksonville that I know of, or in Florida. It was kind of fun to tell the nurses and other people in the hospital all the fine effects that Moxie would have on my recovery. I don't know how much they believed, but I'm sure some of them were believers. So, well, let's see, where do we start? Just a postscript to Monday, I just wanted to say that the real miracle in all this is that God gives us the grace to go through these journeys. And my journey wasn't that difficult compared to what a lot of people have to go through. And I think it's all God's grace. I just wanted to be sure to add that miracles are God's grace in many of these situations. Well, let's see. I wanted to mention a few Bible verses that have been meaningful to me over the years and which have given me instruction and courage and so forth. The first one is in the 12th chapter of Genesis, where God says to Abraham, "I'll bless you to be a blessing." And the next one, which really meaningful to me, was the story of Joseph and his brothers in the 50th chapter of Genesis, when his brothers, who had wronged him completely and sold him into slavery and so forth, came to him trembling with fear when he was prime minister of Egypt. And he said, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." And that's been very meaningful to me as I walk through life. And another one is the first chapter of Joshua. And I get this from Margaret Timms, who was sort of a mentor to me, along with a lot of other people here. And she always said that if you want to enter the promised land, and using that metaphorically, whatever your promised land is, you can't wait for them to build a bridge across the Jordan. You got to get your feet wet. And so that's, and then there's the story of David. I remember one time we were having a Bible study about David, and the story of David and Bathsheba came up. And it was early on in my walk, and I used to wonder whether I'm a hypocrite or not, because I couldn't really live up to, nor can anybody, the standards that are kind of set for us. And when I heard the story of David and Bathsheba, and that he repented, and that God sort of forgave him, and God said to him, "You're a man after my own heart," I said to myself, if he can use David, maybe he can use me a little bit. It gave me a little extra courage. And I also like the verse in Malachi that says, "Bring in the tithes and offerings and test me." God says, "Test me. See if I won't open the windows of heaven and pour out a blessing on you." And that has been meaningful in my life. Now, there are a lot of verses in the New Testament on love, which were repeated this morning in the meditation. I won't go through them all now. Maybe I will before the hour's out. But I wanted to just concentrate on being blessed to be a blessing for a while. A lot of my wisdom comes from my wife, Natalie. She reads a lot. She does a lot of research and study. And I never have an original idea, but she always comes up with things that are very helpful to me. And she's also been a real blessing to me. One story that illustrates this well is that when we were early in our marriage, I had a 1948 Pontiac, and I carried around a gallon can of silver shell oil, which came to about 39 cents for 4 quarts. And wherever I drive, this is the late 1950s, wherever I drive, I'd stop and pull a oil stick out, and sure enough, it'd be down 1 or 2 quarts, and I'd pour in 10 or 20 cents worth of silver shell and keep going on my way. And she had a 1940s convertible Ford, which had a lot of miles on it, so we thought we ought to save our money to get a new car, or a better car. And we had accumulated, well, maybe $500, I don't know, doesn't matter. And we were visiting, we went down to Malden, Massachusetts, to visit my widowed stepmother, who was a wonderful person to me. And during the visit and conversation, it came up that she had to have a new furnace for the winter. And of course, I thought, well, you know, that's my obligation. And I didn't want to say anything about it because it was Natalie's. I didn't want to say, hey, let's spend the money on a furnace, because she was looking forward to a new car or a better car. But she said it. She said, well, we got the money for that. Don't worry about it. And that was a blessing to my stepmother, but it was a blessing to me that she felt that way about it. And that was wonderful. And we left there, and we drove to Berwick, Maine, where her folks lived. And her father told us this story. He said that back around the late 30s or early 40s, there was an old forester, woodlot trader, that lived in Berwick. And he was in his 90s. He was a bachelor, no family. And he carried around in his pocket half a dozen savings bank passbooks and kept things in his hat. And he was about to cut a woodlot on the Hubbard Road in Berwick, near where Ann lives in Arden. And he didn't have a way to drag the logs out of the lot after they were cut, so he came to my father-in-law, who had some property in front of his, and said, I'd like to buy a right-of-way to drag my logs out. And my father-in-law said, you don't have to buy it, you can just do it. So the fellow went ahead and cut the logs and dragged them out over Natalie's father's property. And maybe a few weeks or a month later, he came into his office, threw the deed on his desk and said, I'm too old to ever do anything with this again. The property's practically worthless now, so you can have it. So my father-in-law got the deed to that property. Time went on, and he sold a few lots off for housing lots, made a few dollars on that. And then when we were there, he gave the deed to Natalie. He said, I'm not going to do much with this anymore. Maybe someday it'll be worth something. The land was wet, so you couldn't develop it really. And it had just been cut, so there were no logs to cut. Time went on. Oh, and let me interject this. After some time had passed, I had an uncle who had a Cadillac Coupe de Ville with 17,000 miles on it. And he decided he couldn't drive anymore. And he gave us the car. And that's the way it works. Anyways, time went on, and a lot of the trees grew back over 15 or 20 years, and we did some selective cutting and got some income out of it. And then one day I began to notice that there was some interest down on the Hubbard Road, and there was a sod farm company called, I think it's Tucker Sod Farm, Tuckahoe or something like that. And they began making inquiries, and people came to the house and said, would you be interested in selling some of that land? And I said, no. And time went on, and finally they said, well, we have to have that land. And they paid us, a few $100,000 for it. And I just use that as an illustration that when you try to help somebody else out, God takes care of the supply. And you only have to see yourself as a blessing, and God will fill in everything that's needed for that, and then a lot more. One of my favorite stories is about Julius Rosenwald. Anybody know him? Ever hear of him? You've heard of him. Oh, okay. She used to live with us, you know. Julius Rosenwald was the son of Jewish immigrant Germans who lived in Springfield, Illinois, and they were in the clothing business. He was born in 1862, I think. And as near Lincoln's office in Springfield, Illinois, when he was 16, his folks sent him to New York to his uncle's clothing business to apprentice in the business and learn the clothing business. While he was there in New York, he met the senior Goldman of the Golden Sox Company. They became friends. He learned the trade, went back to Chicago, or that area, and began to open a business there. He was reasonably successful, had his ups and downs, and he married a woman whose husband knew, his name was Aaron Nussbaum. He was a good friend of the two partners in the Sears Roebuck Watch Company. That was a watch company to begin with. And Roebuck got sick and couldn't continue in the business, and he had to sell his half. So Richard Sears, went to Nussbaum, who he knew was a friend, and said, would you like to buy half of Sears Roebuck Company? And Nussbaum went to Julius Rosenwald, who was his brother-in-law then, for some financing, and the two of them purchased half of Sears Roebuck for $75,000. And Rosenwald got active in the business and was a very intelligent businessman. And over a period of maybe 10 or 15 years, he moved the total sales of the company from $750,000 a year to over $50 million a year. Yeah. So you can imagine how well Richard Sears liked Julius Rosenwald. Well, anyways, and you can imagine how Julius Rosenwald was profiting from all this. Anyways, Goldman had by this time taken on Sachs as a partner, or Sachs, however you pronounce it. And when they came to the Chicago area, they stayed with Julius Rosenwald. And they were people who took seriously the teachings of the Torah and the Bible. And they were concerned with the plight of the African Americans in this country. And they talked about it a lot. And they wanted to do something because they said, for centuries, we've been persecuted. And we know what it's like. And we see that the black population in America is being persecuted. And we ought to do something to help them. So let me just switch gears here a minute and talk about Booker T. Washington. Booker Washington was born into slavery in 1856, I think it was. And he was young when his mother was, of course, black. His father was an unknown white, who they never knew who he was. So he was born as a slave. And as the war progressed and ended, someone from the federal government came by and told everybody they were free and they'd go wherever they wanted to go. So he went off to West Virginia, I believe it was, and he got a job in a household, a white household, and they were the kind of people that were, that taught the slaves, no, they weren't slaves anymore, but the servants, to read and write, and he learned to read and write. Went off to a normal school and graduated, and then went to a seminary in Washington, D.C. The leaders of the black community at that time said, this fellow has a lot of potential, and they made him the president of Tuskegee Institute, which was quite a thing. He was able to attract the attention of the rich white community, and the president of Standard Oil, Henry Rogers, heard him speak at Madison Square Garden or someplace in New York. I don't know if it was Madison Square Garden. And he got to know him, and he introduced him to Julius Rosenwald. And together, Julius Rosenwald and Booker T. Washington began to do what Booker wanted to do, which was build schools for the blacks across the South. And they got together and they had a plan. First, Julius Rosenwald wanted to finance all the schools, but Booker said, no, you do half, and we'll get the people who are going to use them to do half. So they began building schools all across the South. They built 5,000 schools, believe it or not. And then they added 4,000 libraries to existing schools. Unbelievable. It's, you know, when you think of Isaiah 55, where God says, my thoughts are higher than your thoughts and my ways higher, you can see how those things work, that amazing things happen. And then Julius was so happy with this guy, Booker, that he funneled all his philanthropic gifts in the South through Booker T. Washington, which must have stung a little bit to some some white people. Anyways, and I could go on and tell you about Julius, and he had an endowment he set up. And he made them spend the whole thing. They couldn't keep it. They had to spend it on people. And his idea was that investing the money in people pays a lot more than investing it and having an endowment that goes on and who knows what happens to it after a while. So anyways, I used that as an illustration, and I tried to put in today's terms, today's up-to-date for inflation money, what it would have, what Julius Rosenwald gave, and I figure it's at least $1 billion in today's money. I mean, it wasn't, but can you imagine that? It's hard to imagine that one man, because he believed what God said to Abraham, was able to, in just this case, donate in today's terms what I think, I might not be right, but I think I am, over $1 billion to the help of other people. I just wanted to use that as an illustration that if we just see ourselves as a blessing, and when the opportunity comes up, we do something about that blessing, we don't need to worry about the source. God will supply it. He said, I'll bless you to be a blessing. Okay, where do we go from here? There are a lot of other stories like that that I could tell you. One of my, I think I'll tell you about Alan Emery. Alan Emery served on a board of directors where I was chairman of the board of an insurance company, and we specialized in making loans to churches. And most of those loans were to churches in the South, all kinds of mega churches and regular churches and whatever kind of church it was. And we started collateral mortgage obligations. In other words, we would bundle up mortgages and sell them. And they were good. They weren't like the ones that have been sold recently. And I don't know how many millions of dollars we pumped into churches in the South, but I know one loan was as much as $20 million, but so you multiply that out, it's, I don't know what it would amount to. It doesn't matter. But anyways, Alan was on the board, and Alan was from the Boston area. He ended up being chairman of the board of the Billy Graham Association for about 40 years. And we used to have breakfast on the day of board meetings, and we would talk about business and so on and so forth. And he would he was a person who gave very generously to all kinds of projects, particularly in the church, and he spent a lot of time on them. And one day we were having breakfast, and he told me about his business. His folks had the wool business in Boston. World War II came along, and he joined the Coast Guard, and he learned to swab decks there. He became a captain of a ship by the time the war was over, one of those ships that was at the Philippines when MacArthur landed. I'm not sure he was the captain, but he was probably executive officer. He came back, and the wool business has gone because of the advent of nylon and all those types of things. So he said, I had to look around for a business, and I knew how to swab decks. I knew how to mop the floor in a wool plant. So I decided I'd start a cleaning business. So he started the cleaning business because he was in the hospital visiting people who were sick from his church. And he saw the people in the hospital cleaning. And he said, they don't know how to clean. I can do a better job than that. So he went to that hospital and said, would you hire me as an independent contractor to clean your rooms? And they did. So he started that cleaning business, and it grew. And he met some other people who were doing the same thing. And they got together and started Service Master Corporation. And that morning at breakfast, and I'm not supposed to tell this, but I'll tell it anyway because I think he's long gone. He said, "Joe, I just paid my quarterly income tax." He said, "How much do you think it was?" I said, "I don't know." He said, "Over $1 million. I mean, that was just, you know, how a guy got blessed. Now, I don't think blessings necessarily come as financial rewards to everybody. But I think there are other things. We had a gal at work for us named Rose. Did you remember Rose? Rose had nothing. Rose had an old car. In fact, she had an old Cadillac that someone had given her. And it was always full of clothes and food and so forth. And she would come and clean our house and do things like that. And then she'd go off with this car full of clothes and stuff and deliver stuff to people who were in need and all kinds of things. Wonderful, wonderful person. I don't think she ever had $100 in the bank. But she was one of the nicest, most blessed persons I ever met. And what I'm trying to say is that I'm talking about money things because that's been my business and I know about it. But there are lots of other things where being a blessing, God will take care of you. And even if you're not financially rich or something like that. And there's people who are intercessors doing all kinds of things. And they are more blessed probably than most of the financial people I know. The couple I've talked about, of course, are exceptions to the rule. So let's see. I'm like David Hawks here. Still got 10 minutes to go. But I wanted to just talk a little bit about money and what makes sense. And I think the thing Margaret Tim said is, don't wait to cross the Jordan until they build a bridge. Go in and get your feet wet. And as I look around, I often see projects that don't get done because people are afraid to go out on a limb. It's not so in CFO. I mean, we saw the budget last night. What do we need, $16,000? Yeah. As far as I know, and I've been here since 1967, it's always been that way. And God has always met it. And it's been so in Acadia, too. Every time I've been there, there's been a deficit, and God has always met it. In fact, I've had people come up to me at Acadia and say, how much shall I give, you know? And I try to be honest, and I usually say such and such an amount. And they say, well, I could give twice that, you know. But we still get everything we need. Being blessed to be a blessing is really very scriptural, very biblical. And I think everybody ought to take the courage of Joshua crossing the Jordan to go into their promised land, whatever it is. Well, it's 6 minutes of, and I don't want to start another long story, so why don't we cut it there and give you 5 minutes to get to the rhythms. Thank you.